Hi, I'm Lauren Gilger, co-host of the show, one of KJZZ's original productions. It's a program with news and features from across Phoenix and the state. You can find much more at theshow.kjzz.org. Here's today's episode.
Good morning and welcome to the show right here on KJZZ 91.5 FM. In Phoenix, I'm Sam Dingman.
And I'm Lauren Gilger. Coming up, new questions about the effectiveness of Phoenix's Cool Pavement program.
And how is Kamala Harris's campaign being met by Black and Latino voters?
But first, Vice President Kamala Harris is heading to Arizona this week on the heels of Vice Presidential candidate J.D. Vance's visit here last week. And the political world is on fire with speculation about a Harris running mate pick. Arizona Senator Mark Kelly is among the finalists for the gig, word has it. So once again, Arizona is finding itself at the center of the political world. And our own Ben Giles is here to talk more about it. Good morning, Ben.
Good morning.
So you are living this, right? You'll be at Kamala Harris's rally here this week. You were there when J.D. Vance spoke to a crowd in Glendale last week. Let's talk about what we saw in presidential politics in Arizona last week. Like, start with J.D. Vance. What did we hear from him in Glendale?
Well, it was Vance's first trip through the Southwest. He also made two stops in Nevada before he was in Glendale on Wednesday evening, trying to pin what he describes as the failures of the Biden administration directly on Kamala Harris. And in fact, at the border in Cochise County on Thursday morning, he used this one particular phrase, the Harris administration, multiple times during comments to reporters along the southern border. It's a part of the Trump-Vance strategy of shifting focus to Harris now that she is the likely Democratic nominee. The campaign had obviously pretty effectively attacked President Biden when he was still in the running, but now they've had to shine the spotlight on Harris and are trying to pin, again, what they describe as the failures of that administration directly on the vice president.
The Harris administration, that's really interesting. Ben, how much do you think the border, Arizona, immigration will play into their new tactics in terms of how the Trump campaign is going to go after Kamala Harris?
In Arizona, quite a bit. Immigration is a big consequential issue for this state and for border communities like some of those in Cochise County. The border and securing the border might be the biggest issue to those communities. And the Trump campaign certainly thinks it's going to be a winning issue, although we should note that illegal border crossings are far, far down than they were earlier in the Biden administration. The last 5 months, they've been on the decline.
Right, right. So tell us, Ben, what do we expect to hear then on the Democratic side this week? We have Kamala Harris heading to Arizona later this week. Mark Kelly's in the mix. What kind of issues are going to be top of mind on that side?
Well, I think we'll hear a lot from the vice presidential pick this week. There's some reports this morning that announcement is coming tomorrow, likely before her first campaign stop as a part of this swing through seven swing states. She's starting in Philadelphia on Tuesday. But I think the arguments will be tailored to those specific states. And I think for Arizona, you are going to hear about the border from the Harris campaign. You are going to hear about her efforts to slow down migration from Central American countries. That was a big issue when Biden first took office in 2021. You're also going to hear about how border crossings have declined, and you're going to hear a little bit of a blame game on Trump and Republicans in Congress, but Trump specifically discouraging Republicans in the U.S. Senate from voting on a bipartisan border security bill that folks like Mark Kelly were pushing for earlier this year. Trump did publicly discourage Republicans in Congress from supporting that measure. And the Harris campaign is likely going to use that as a cudgel to say Trump wants to use the border as a political talking point rather than actually coming up with solutions.
That's interesting. So they're not on the Harris side running away from the border or immigration as an issue. What about abortion? That's always been a central issue in Arizona politics in the last, couple of years, as it has been pretty much everywhere. We're going to hear Democrats talking a lot about that here.
Absolutely. Even before Harris became the likely Democratic presidential nominee, she made multiple trips to Arizona to highlight the issue of abortion. We obviously made national headlines earlier this year when the Arizona Supreme Court ruled that an 1860s territorial era near total abortion ban could take effect. That law has since been repealed, but abortion is literally on the ballot in Arizona this year with a citizen initiative that would make abortion legal up to 24 weeks and would actually prevent the state legislature from restricting access to abortion in state law. So candidates from Harris to Congressman Ruben Gallego running for Senate mm-hmm. to candidates for legislative office are going to be hitching their wagon to that initiative and hoping that it succeeds and they along with it.
What does the polling look like on these issues, though, right now, Ben, in Arizona? Like, is abortion as salient an issue as the border is?
They're both, I'd say immigration is a little higher, but they're both up there. And abortion, it just depends on who you talk to. Mm-hmm. But there is certainly room for the Harris campaign to make pitches to voters on both of those issues. And I'm sure you'll hear both of them come Friday night when Harris is expected in Phoenix campaigning alongside her new vice presidential nominee, perhaps Mark Kelly.
Right. Whoever that may be. Last question about Mark Kelly and a potential VP running mate slot for him. How likely is this? What's the latest on this? As you said, this announcement could come today or tomorrow.
Yeah, it really could be Kelly. He is, as you said in your opening, one of the finalists. He was reportedly interviewed in Washington by Harris's vetting team for this vice presidential role. He's an astronaut. He's a military veteran. He has a very personal story to tell when it comes to gun violence because of the tragic shooting in 2011 of his wife, then Congresswoman Gabrielle Giffords. So there's a lot of compelling stories for Mark Kelly and his family to tell on the campaign trail that I think play into a lot of the issues that the Harris campaign wants to highlight, not the least of which Kelly has fashioned himself as a bit of a truth teller when it comes to criticizing his own party, the Democratic Party. Mm-hmm. He was critical of the Biden administration early on when he was first elected to U.S. Senate for the border crisis. So somebody who's a center-right kind of center-left moderate Democrat mm-hmm. Could be a compelling candidate to run alongside Harris.
All right. We'll leave it there for now and watch for who's the pick. Ben Giles, KJZZ's political editor, joining us. Ben, thanks as always.
Thanks, Lauren.
Well, here in Phoenix, we are, of course, always on the lookout for innovative solutions to extreme heat. And back in 2020, the city launched a partnership with ASU on a so-called cool pavement program. And a few years in, the results are at best inconclusive. Joining us now to talk more about this is Amy Cutler, an investigative journalist for Arizona's Family, who has been reporting on some recent controversies with cool pavement. Amy, good morning.
Good morning. Thanks for having me.
Thanks for joining us. So first, let's define some terms here. When we talk about cool pavement, we're not actually talking about the pavement itself, but rather a coating that is applied to the pavement, right?
Exactly right. It's that, and people might have seen it on roads. It's on over 100 miles of roadway across the city of Phoenix. It's that gray, silver kind of coating instead of the traditional blacktop that's on the roads now.
And so this treatment was a part of a program launched in partnership with ASU. And what did the research at the time promise about this coating?
So the city is quick to tout that at the ground level, this coating makes the ground up to 12 degrees cooler, which is substantial. But then the issue becomes when you get off the ground, and 6 feet off the ground is where there's less of a differential. Researchers found it was just 0.3 of a degree cooler 6 feet off the ground.
That is a very large difference.
Yes.
And so one of the other major issues there is reflectivity. Tell us what that means.
Yeah, exactly right. So the sun that is, instead of the rays of the sun or energy, the blacktop tends to absorb that energy. The idea is that the silver or gray coating would reflect it, but unfortunately that energy doesn't just go away, it's reflected off the ground. So it's absorbed by the homes or buildings around it, or researchers found pedestrians walking on the roadway would reflect it or would absorb it as well. And so that can make pedestrians up to 5 degrees hotter.
Oh, dear. So if I'm hearing you correctly, while this coating may literally be making the pavement cooler, the people and homes might actually be getting hotter.
Exactly right. Exactly right. So that's why there's been some mixed reviews here on what researchers have found.
And so far, the city has spent about $15 million on this program, right?
Yes, $15 million over the last 4 years.
And for your piece, you went out into some areas of the city where this money has been spent and talked to folks. Tell us what they told you.
Yeah, it was really interesting. There's a lot of mixed opinions about this. Some people really feel like anything the city can do to make a difference here is worth the money. They really were supportive of it. Some even said that they liked the way it looked, that it was kind of different and modern. Other people really hated this stuff. They said that they didn't see any difference. They thought it was ugly. They felt like you could see the tire marks on it, that it wasn't wearing as well as it should. So lots of different opinions on this. And, you know, that's what we found in terms of checking out different spots. We went to 5 different locations where the cool pavement had been put down over the last 4 years. And some spots, it seemed to hold up a little bit better than other spots. And that was a question we posed to the city too, because one of their big claims on this is that because it makes the ground a little less hot, the infrastructure under the road wouldn't be impacted and so would last longer. So they claim that the cool pavement lasts at least twice as long as a traditional blacktop ceiling. But when we were driving around and looking at it, you couldn't really see much of a difference just a few years out.
Gotcha. And since you mentioned going to the city with some of the concerns that have cropped up here, what else did they tell you about your findings?
Well, so they defended them and said that over time, the coating is just going to fade. But interestingly enough, now they are testing another type of cool pavement, a different manufacturer for the coating. And right now the program is on hold because they say that there are some texture and thickness issues. This is the second time this has happened. So they actually haven't put down any cool pavement, the city says, this entire summer, which is the main time that they do the main paving season. So they haven't put any of the stuff down and they're going to go with a different manufacturer. And they're hoping that the thickness and texture issues will be resolved with this new product.
And Amy, do we know if this sort of treatment has been effective in other cities that deal with extreme heat? Are we just too hot to handle?
Yeah, it's a good question. So when we were looking, Los Angeles actually pioneered this this idea. And so they have a lot of cool pavement that's down. And they went with the manufacturer that the city of Phoenix is switching to. And so they have had some success. It hasn't been as widespread there as it is in Phoenix. And I should also note that other cities, you know, are taking note of this, and there are other cities that are starting to use this cool pavement. I think that there's a big feeling out there that while the research into this is new and mixed, it is just getting so hot that these cities want to do something. They want to address the issue. And, you know, at surface level, it seems like it would be a good idea, right? It, you know, 12 degrees hotter on the ground seems like, you know, win-win. It's just when you kind of take a closer dive into this where you realize that there, you know, it might not be as good as you know, how what it seems, I guess.
Gotcha. And last question for you, Amy. You mentioned that the program is currently on hold. Do we have any sense of how soon we might get an update on the possibility of this new manufacturer?
Yes. So the city says that they are going to start putting down this new coating later on this month in August. But I should point out, I started asking questions about this back in May. And at the time, they said that it was going to, you know, they were going to start putting it down in June. Then it was July. Now it's August. So I don't have an exact sense of what the holdup is. I mean, if they're just trying to get the product or if they're trying to do some more testing or what the situation is. But they are saying that they are planning to put down more cool pavement later on this month.
All right. Well, we'll have to leave it there. That is Amy Cutler, an investigative journalist for Arizona's Family. Amy, thank you for your reporting and thank you for the conversation.
Thanks.
Good morning. It is the show on KJZZ 91.5. I'm Lauren Gilger.
And I'm Sam Dingman.
As we heard earlier in the show, Vice President Kamala Harris's campaign is heading to Arizona this week, and all eyes are on a few potential vice presidential picks that include Arizona Senator Mark Kelly. So now let's turn to more on the Harris campaign and how it's being met by some of the most important voting blocs for Democrats, Black voters and Latino voters. Before President Biden stepped aside just a few weeks ago, he was losing support among these key demographics. But that could be changing now that Harris is at the top of the ticket. And here to talk about both groups and how they're responding to a Harris ticket are Elvia Diaz, editorial page editor at the Arizona Republic, and columnist Greg Moore. Good morning to you both.
Good morning.
Hey, good morning.
All right, Greg, I want to start with you here. You wrote a column about a big moment in the campaign recently from former President Donald Trump when he appeared at the National Association of Black Journalists conference last week. I mean, there was a lot of controversy, first of all, just about whether or not he should even be there, whether or not they should do this interview. You say it was a good thing that he was there. Tell us why.
Oh, absolutely. It was a good thing. So first of all, Donald Trump is running for president. So he should be talking to journalists so that we can ask the questions on behalf of the American people to find out whether this is the kind of guy we want to represent us. And if he's talking to journalists, he needs to be talking to all journalists, and Black journalists, last time I checked, were journalists. So yeah, absolutely, he needed to be there.
So the moderator, ABC's Rachel Scott, started this off in a really poignant way. She asked Trump the first thing, basically, you know, whether or not Black voters, why Black voters should trust him, given his history of things he has said about and to people of color. What's your take on his answer and what happened next?
Well, Donald Trump went full Donald Trump. It was amazing. Like, if you just look at it as political theater, it was great. The way that Donald Trump plays the political game, it's like watching improv. It's like watching performance art. It's amazing. Rachel Scott's question was the question that anyone wanted to know the answer to. Donald Trump, you've said this, you've said that. And I could go through it list by list, but it was a very long question because it needed to be. Mm-hmm. So what did Trump do? Rather than address what Rachel Scott asked, Donald Trump said, wow, I don't know if I've ever been asked such a rude question in such a rude way. That was horrible. And oh, by the way, where do you work? At ABC? That's a horrible organization. It's a fake news organization. Mm-hmm. Donald Trump went full Donald Trump. He had an absolute opportunity to tell Black voters, hey, guys, I know some of the things might have sounded harsh. That's just my way. I'm very blunt. I'm very plain spoken. But if you look at my actions and you look at my heart and you see what I've been able to do, you'll understand that my heart is in the right place and your concerns are my concerns. That's not what he did. Mm-hmm. Donald Trump was Donald Trump.
Let me ask you about what you make of the at least chipping away at Black support for the Democratic Party, at least before Kamala Harris took over the ticket, right? Like, this has been a traditionally Democratic stronghold, and we've seen that support sort of disintegrate in the last little bit of time here. What do you make of that? Why do you think that is?
So the Black support is always going to be key in a presidential election for a couple of reasons. The trick is whether the Democrats actually get up, get out, and go vote. Mm. That means they need someone to be excited about. And nobody was excited about Joe Biden. Kamala Harris, though, listen, she comes out. She's an AKA. She went to Howard. She knows how to connect with Black people by telling a story of having to overcome, of having to do a little bit more to get people to take her seriously. As far as I can tell, Black people are overwhelmingly in favor of voting for Harris, but they're excited to do it. Mm-hmm. That's the trick. If you want to get specific on the numbers, Barack Obama was taking like 9.5 out of every 10 Black voters. I mean, the support was unreal, off the charts. Hillary Clinton was only taking 7.5 out of every 10 Black voters, and they weren't excited to vote for her. And that created enough margin to give Trump room to take the election in the first place. If Kamala Harris pushes closer to where Obama was, and it looks like she's capable of doing that, I think this election is going to be I think she's going to have the upper hand going into November.
Super interesting. OK, so then I want to turn to you, Elvia, and talk about Harris and Latino voters. You wrote that you are surprised at the level of enthusiasm that you're seeing.
Yes, no, absolutely. And you know what? I wanted to go back to what Greg was saying first about whether Donald Trump should have spoken to the Black journalists at the association. Everyone is now saying, yes, absolutely, including Greg. Absolutely, Donald Trump should have spoken to a journalist. But I'm wondering if it is because the outcome of that interview, I mean, the journalists were fantastic and getting right at the point, asking the pointed questions and then clearly fact checking him right from the beginning. And then Trump did terrible. I mean, he essentially killed the interview himself. So I'm wondering if in retrospect, that's why, you know, people are not saying it was a great thing. But if you have had, you know, reporters who would just ask questions, I bet the conversation would have been more about what should journalists and certain groups give Donald Trump a platform to begin with, just to lie and attack, you know, the canvas. But we'll see, right? And talking about the Latino vote, I think Greg got it right. And I think it's almost the same as with African Americans, that largely Latinos tend to be Democrats, but they were not excited. I will say, just like African Americans, they were not totally excited about Joe Biden. And they needed someone that they could identify with, that they could see a future with. I mean, that there's a difference between the campaign tone already. You know, Biden was talking about saving democracy, kind of the old playbook, and old meaning 3 years ago, 4 years ago. That's how quickly things change.
Absolutely.
To more about, we're not going back. You know, this is the future. We're building something new. Mm-hmm. I think that's definitely resonating with minorities as well, with Latinos, and especially young Latinos. I think Trump has gotten more support from young Latino men, not necessarily from Latinos across the board, mm-hmm. but now the excitement on the other side is real, is palpable, it's there. I think what I was surprised is not necessarily the support, but the intensity and the enthusiasm of that support of Latinos for Kamala Harris.
Okay, so let me ask you both here at the end a question about identity politics, right? Like, Kamala Harris's campaign and the candidate herself, interestingly, are not really making this about her identity, even though she would be the first president who is a woman. She would be the first president who is Black and South Asian and a woman. This is, you know, historic in many ways, but we're not seeing the kind of language we saw when Hillary Clinton ran, you know, the I'm with her t-shirts, you know, several years ago. Why do you think that is? You want to start with that one, Greg?
Yeah, sure. I mean, Barack Obama was using the same strategy. Barack Obama didn't come out and say, I'm the Black president. He said, I'm the president for all of America. At least that's what I'm trying to be. Look, when you are Black, and I can only imagine what it's like for Black women from the perspective that I know a whole bunch of them, you can't deny that. You don't need to talk about it. It is you. As soon as you walk into a room, everybody sees the Black guy's in here or the Black woman is in here, especially when they're not accustomed to seeing people who look like you in spaces like that. There's no need for her to talk about it. Everybody else is talking about it. All she needs to do is lay out her qualifications, which are pretty strong. Last time I checked, she was a vice president. She was a prosecutor. She rose through the ranks in California. Like, this is a strong candidate here. And she doesn't need to play identity politics because everybody else is going to play it for her.
Elvia, what's your take there?
Yeah, absolutely. She doesn't need to. I mean, Donald Trump in that interview with the Black journalist, I mean, that was a headline, one of the headlines out of it, right? Whether she's really Black, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, essentially, he questioned the idea that she turned Black when it was convenient for her. Well, no. I mean, again, she cannot hide the fact. So no need to say the obvious in this case, right? I mean, they are going to do it for her. And you know what? When people talk about identity politics, I always say, yes, it is true. Identity politics does exist. And we have been seeing that since the beginning of this country, except that it's always been about white people being in power. I mean, that's identity politics. You know, when one race, when one sort of group of people had been in power since the beginning of this country. But, you know, clearly the rest of the population only see identity politics when it comes to minority. That's ridiculous.
That's a really interesting point to end on there. Okay. Much more to say on all of these fronts, I'm sure, but we'll end it there for now. Elvia Diaz, editorial page editor for the Arizona Republic, joined by Greg Moore, columnist this morning. Thank you both for coming on. Thanks for giving us your take here. I appreciate it.
Thank you.
Absolutely. Thanks for having me.
Good morning. It's the show on KJZZ 91.5. I'm Lauren Gilger.
And I'm Sam Dingman. It is a tense morning around the world on this Monday, and the BBC's Rob Hugh Jones is here to help us make sense of the latest international headlines. Rob, good morning.
Yes, good morning, Sam.
Rob, let's start in Bangladesh, where it has already been a very significant day. The prime minister has resigned and fled the country. What can you tell us?
Yeah. The Prime Minister, Sheikh Hasina, who's been in power there for 15 years, and actually she was Prime Minister before that as well in the 1990s. She has, as you say, resigned and fled the country. And General Waqar Uz-Zaman, who's the head of the army, has said he is talking to political leaders and he's promised that the army will maintain peace. That should really be restore peace, because we haven't seen much peace in Bangladesh in the last couple of weeks. And that's because it all began with the students who are protesting about jobs, civil service jobs, government jobs being reserved for those whose families fought in the War of Independence in Bangladesh in 1971. But those protests have turned into something much bigger, which is the Prime Minister fleeing her residence shortly before that was looted by gangs who went in and took furniture, for example. There's all kinds of video now of people kind of running away with sofas and chairs and anything else they could loot from the official residence. And we understand that she, Sheikh Hasina, has left the country to India, neighboring India, on an army helicopter. So it's a massive day for Bangladesh, and the army is stepping in saying, we will form an interim government, we will restore or maintain peace. But we should just remember that Bangladesh once had a military in charge and things didn't go too well.
All right, so a tense situation there to monitor. And speaking of protests and violence, let's turn now to Britain. What is the latest there? There's been a good deal of that as well over the weekend.
There really has. So there have been a whole range of protests, some of which have been violent. And that's really centered on something that happened a week ago on Monday, the 29th of July, when a young man, alleged young man, went into a Taylor Swift-themed dance party where they were doing dance and yoga and jewelry making and all that kind of thing with young children, and killed three young girls, put another eight, I believe it is, in hospital, and two adults as well, some of whom are critical, that group. So this was a big shock to the country and to the small town, seaside town, near Liverpool, where this happened. That led to a vigil, of course, and people coming together to mourn what had happened. But then that led to a lot of disinformation on social media, and people were blaming this young man, this alleged young man, as being a Muslim or a migrant or having come over on a boat from continental Europe, being an asylum seeker, all kinds of stuff about him, which, by the way, is not true. if we're talking about the alleged perpetrator, because actually he was born here in Britain to Rwandan parents, and he did not come here as a refugee, a migrant, or asylum seeker, or anything else. But anyway, this has led to violent protests sparked around the country, joined by lots of far-right groups, and that's what we're seeing now. And we saw a lot more of that on Saturday and Sunday, and the government had an emergency meeting here this morning, gathering ministers, civil servants, you name it, to try and stem this and to stop it from escalating.
And Rob, this is a bit of an early test, is it not, for the new Prime Minister, Keir Starmer?
That's right. So he's that election was, what, July the 4th, something like that. So it's very recent that this government have come to power under Keir Starmer. The Conservatives were in power here for 14 years before Labour came in. So, you know, this is a very new government. And this is and August, by the way, you know, is normally supposed to be a pretty quiet month, when really you get, you know, the government, the parliament is not sitting. There's not normally that much going on. And so they would have expected a month to kind of prepare themselves for the fall, for the autumn, and to get on with things thereafter. But actually, quite the reverse. They're being severely tested at the moment by what's going on.
And were the issues that the protesters are up in arms about, are those an extension of issues that were debated during the recent election?
Yes, they were. So immigration is a very hot button issue in this country, as of course it is in the US and so many others. And that's why we've seen hotels, for example, that are thought to be housing asylum seekers in this country being attacked. And that's happened a number of times in these recent protests. You know, if you go online, you'll see people attacking some of these quite well-known hotels, even starting fires in the doorways and that kind of thing, and shouting kind of, you know, get them out. And there are people talking to the BBC, for example, saying, why should we pay our taxes for these people to be housed in, you know, fine hotels and so on. So it's a big issue here, as it was, by the way, in Brexit. This country, you know, Britain left the European Union back in 2020, and that Brexit vote, which was 4 years earlier, a lot of that centered on exactly this.
Well, let's round out our conversation, Rob, by pivoting to Cambodia, where things are relatively calm in light of all this unrest we've been discussing. It's a very big day in Cambodia, and it's all about a canal. Tell us what's happening.
That's right. So Cambodia, of course, Southeast Asia, and a very poor nation. In fact, it's one of the poorest in the world. You know, you look at the sort of trading issues Cambodia has. Well, it relies very heavily on its neighbors, particularly Vietnam, to export its produce, for example. So today what's happening is the groundbreaking, the official groundbreaking ceremony is happening there in Cambodia for a canal that's going to be built from the capital, just south of the capital, Phnom Penh, which is in the kind of southern half of the country, to the coast, to the Gulf of Thailand. And what it will do is link the capital effectively with Cambodia's only deep water port. And that will make Cambodia a lot more independent in terms of its trading with the rest of the world. And that's why Hun Sen, the former leader in Cambodia, is making a big issue of this. It happens to be his birthday, by the way, this week. He's tying it in with that.
Oh.
And it's obviously, indeed, and it's obviously something of a legacy project.
Now, the canal is not without controversy, though, correct?
That's right, because Cambodia is a firm ally of China, and it's always a question mark as to who's funding these projects. You know, has Cambodia got the money to do this? Well, there's a Chinese company that's effectively building it. And, of course, people are questioning, well, is China actually funding this? And if so, what kind of influence does that allow China over Cambodia? So there are questions about that. The other question is that it sort of interferes with or links the Mekong River. And there's a lot of controversy about that because so many countries rely on the Mekong. And so this is controversial for that reason, too.
So some wariness hovering around the edges of the Prime Minister's birthday party there.
Indeed.
All right. Well, that is the BBC's Rob Hugh-Jones giving us this roundup of some international news this morning. Rob, thank you so much as always.
Yeah, thanks so much, Sam.
The Arizona Supreme Court ruled last week that the state is not responsible for court-ordered expenses related to a longtime desegregation case in the Tucson Unified School District. Now the state doesn't have to reimburse Pima County for taxes levied to pay for TUSD's programs designed to bring the district into compliance and equitably serve all students. I spoke more about the financial implications with Adelita Grijalva, chair of the Pima County Board of Supervisors and former member of the TUSD School Board, starting with why the case began.
One of the reasons that TUSD was, I think, rightfully put under court oversight is because we had dual school systems. We had schools for children of color and schools for everybody else, and they were not equal, not equitable. And so we had to go through a series and decades of federal oversight look like, what a unitary status plan looked like. For a minute there, I was on the TUSD governing board for 20 years. For a moment there, about a year and a half, we were unitary. Mm-hmm. And then we were brought back under court oversight because the argument was we didn't fully address the needs of students of color.
Right. So how has the district in the last several years then been able to do that? It was released from court order finally in 2022. Does that mean all is well?
It means that everything is equitable and equal. You know, when we first came under court order, and I was a student in TUSD. I graduated from Pueblo High School in 1989. Mm-hmm. And we knew in just going and visiting other campuses that some campuses on the east side of town had better access to facilities. Their stuff looked nicer. Their books looked newer than we had at our school. Mm-hmm. And that was part of the argument. And so making sure that addressing the need for access to a quality education, including discipline disparities, facilities and technology, transportation, access, community engagement, all of those were benchmarks that we had to meet. And according to the judge, we did.
Okay. So let's talk a little bit about what difference that's probably made for students. I know you're on the County Board of Supervisors now, no longer with the TUSD board, but has that long journey toward equitability made a big difference in the lives of the kids in Tucson who go to this district?
Absolutely. I mean, I can see the difference from when I was a student. My children actually attend all the same schools that I did. Mm-hmm. And you see the difference because for the most part, it not only allowed for access and equality in that way, but we also opened up magnet programs. I mean, so there aren't these limitations based on where you live. Transportation is being offered to a lot of different programs that highlight arts and music, dual language, technology, and then all of those programs continue to evolve based on the needs of our community and the interests of students. And mm-hmm. So I think that the district is doing the best they can to make sure that everything is equitable and accessible for any child, regardless of what side of town they live in.
All right. So let's talk now about what's gone on recently with this at the Arizona Supreme Court. They ruled that the state does not have to reimburse Pima County for taxes levied for the programs that stem from this decades-long desegregation case. First of all, what do those programs look like?
Well, I mean, they are throughout the school system. And so you have math interventionists, reading interventionists, aides in different classrooms, depending on what the program is. There's so many advanced learning experience programs that are paid for out of DSEG funds. And so what this means is it's not all of the DSEG. It's a percentage over. So it looks like $8 or $9 million mm-hmm. that will not be reimbursed.
Right. Like how much of a cost burden will that be on the district itself, on the taxpayers in that district in terms of trying to budget going forward just as the school year is getting underway?
Well, the programs will still continue. They'll just have to be impacted in some way to reduce by $8 or $9 million if that's the direction that the TUSD board decides to go into. But I do think it's important for the district to continue to provide these programs because what we're saying here is that it's these programs and the equity across the district that prevents us sliding into a dual system again, hmm. where we have a system and schools that are the have and the have nots. That's what we want to ensure does not happen. And so being unitary means that we still have requirements that are court ordered in order to meet the expectation that we're not going to fall backwards into a dual school system. And remember, when there's any achievement gap, what ends up happening is those that are impacted are children of color and children in poverty. And that's what we're trying to make sure, that all of the students have equitable access to really amazing programs. And that's what TUSD's done. And I know that they'll continue to do. And hopefully, if there are any cuts that have to be made, that they can be made as far away from the classroom as possible.
Mm-hmm. Are you concerned that that kind of backward slide might happen here?
Hopefully not. I mean, I do think that we have a board that understands some of the nuances here. We have a superintendent, Dr. Trujillo, who's been a part of working towards being unitary. And so provided all of those things continue to stay stable, I think we have a school system that's very prepared to be able to address some of these changes. But it is an election year, and three of the board members' positions are up, and any major changes in the majority mean changes to a lot of leadership.
All right. We will see what happens then. Adelita Grijalva, chair of the Pima County Board of Supervisors, joining us. Thank you for coming on. Thanks for your perspective here. Appreciate it.
Thank you.
Good morning. It is the show on KJZZ 91.5. I'm Lauren Gilger.
And I'm Sam Dingman. If you've been following the debate over generative AI, you probably know that the conversation tends to break down into two camps, evangelists and naysayers. You can find just as many people who think this technology is going to save the world as you can folks who believe it will bring about the end of civilization. Well, writer Paul Ford has been covering technology for decades, and in moments like this, he has a mantra. It's just software. If you can separate yourself from the heated debate, Ford says, you can see technological innovations for what they actually are. And as he writes in his latest piece for Wired magazine, in the case of generative AI, there's nothing to fear, except perhaps ourselves.
It is a robot, and it has no idea what it's saying. It really doesn't. It seems like it does, but it doesn't. It is just wacky Mad Libs going at a mile a minute, taking all the data that's in the world and aligning it with what you jammed into the box and saying, like, I think you want me to say this, but not even that. It's a talking spreadsheet. And it's really fun because I don't know about you. I mean, you work at an NPR affiliate, so you are probably extremely driven by shame. And like, shame,
no comment.
Shame, yeah. I mean, I'm a writer and I'm always like kind of editing in my head, like what I get to say. And then the robot showed up like a bunch of drunken uncles just rambling about absolute nonsense. It's like a mixture of a prize salesman and a goofy toddler. And it's really ridiculous.
Yeah, yeah. You know, it feels to me a little bit like what you're saying is that we're so busy endowing AI with all of this power, whether we think that power will be used for good or for ill, that we have forgotten to pause and realize, to use your word, how goofy it is.
Look, it does a magic trick. Eventually, we're all going to kind of know how that magic trick looks. And you're going to, who goes back and sees a magic show the second time?
Right.
You know, you can now, everybody's increasingly, like, you can see the weird edges on the images that it generates. You're like, it's not just that it puts in multiple fingers. It just, you can tell something feels off. And so, like, we're going to get an immune system, a cultural and mental immune system. And we're going to just kind of like get used to it, and then we'll find the things it's actually good at.
I feel like what you're expressing is in a way quite profound, because thought about in these terms, it is very easy and perhaps even advisable to dismiss AI to a certain degree as a kind of an unserious thing that we are in a rush to make very serious. But there is also this way in which it does kind of represent something very real about human psychology, which is that we all kind of have this desire to be like, is this what you want? Is this what you want? How about this? I'll keep trying. I can do better. And that is something weirdly relatable about that.
Well, I mean, remember Castaway? Like, you know, I still feel sad for that volleyball. It did its best. And he had to say, we anthropomorphize absolutely everything, from stuffed animals to, mascots at the sports team. I mean, just like we anthropomorphize everything. And I think what is tricky, I remember there's a very good thinker, a very practical thinker on this, a guy named Simon Willison. And he sort of feels that the cardinal sin of this world is the anthropomorphization, like making them seem like people, giving them names, like constantly trying to fake a human on the other side as an assistant, as opposed to kind of just producing the data in a more like overtly robotic way, because you're hacking human psychology when you do that. You're not actually
right,
like adding a lot of value or teaching people a lot about the technology. You're teaching them that, yeah, you really treat it like a human and it'll work out. And that actually doesn't get people into what these things can really do. They can do all sorts of wacky stuff that maybe if you weren't thinking it as a human, you might be more likely to explore.
Right. Well, because in a way, generative AI is able to do things that most of us are not able to do. As you write, quote, it does everything badly and confidently, mm-hmm. and I want to be it.
Well, it's that shame thing again. I mean, imagine just, you know, you see how much fun it is to be shameless, right? Like we have political candidates who are utterly shameless. They just get away with, they say whatever they want and they get away with it. And it can be a little horrifying, but oh my God, like imagine just being that free for like 5 minutes, just making stuff up. I just feel, it feels great. They don't ask permission. It's all forgiveness.
And speaking of the kind of real life analogs of this type of shamelessness that we see AI reflecting back at us, one of the comparisons or alignments, perhaps would be a better word, that you do make in the piece is that the way that AI behaves sort of mirrors the at least public behaviors of the people who are constantly out evangelizing it, constantly out saying the world wants this technology that so many people are saying back to them, we did not ask for this, we don't want it, and by the way, we're suing you because you stole all our work. And yet they just keep going, saying like, no, this will be the future.
If you want to go meta, like really, really meta for a minute, right? Like one of the things I'm talking about in the piece, but I think this is real, there is no superpower like shamelessness. You can get to incredible heights in our culture. And so you have people running AI companies saying, this is actually going to become intelligent really soon. There isn't a clear path. Like there isn't a way to get there that I see. But they're just promising, like, it's just going to keep getting better faster and faster. Just you wait. But the ability to just get out there and just throw it out there and be like, hey, you guys figure it out, I'm going to tell you what you should believe, is a superpower. And people who footnote everything and have to get fact-checked when they write their magazine articles, they don't have that superpower, right? Like they're accountable in a different way. And we like that. We like that in our society. We say we do. But then we go to the concerts and vote for the people who are the most shameless. And these robots have it in spades.
Yeah. But it does seem to me, if I'm reading your piece correctly, that when the tool is perhaps inevitably improved, something in your mind will be lost. You write that these tools as they currently exist, quote, mirror the arrogant, repetitive ramblings of our betters, the horrific confidence that keeps us driving over the same cliffs. That arrogance will be sculpted down and smoothed over, but it will have been the most accurate representation of who we truly are to exist so far, a real mirror of our folly. So is that fair to say? You think in a way we will lose something when generative AI gets more useful?
We always lose when the first days are over, right? Like, and the fantasy has to go away. The early days of the web, we were going to publish our zines online and use things like GeoCities, and there'd be animated GIFs, and we would all connect as a culture, and it would just be the absolute best future possible, and everyone would like publish their fan fiction. It was really, you know, it was full of light, and now it's for banking and harassment. Like, you know, so it's sort of like, so it's the same thing. We're in the zone of folly. Everyone, you can say absolutely anything about this technology, and no one can really prove you wrong. And at the same time, because they tried to make this thing seem like a human, it's the worst human. It's just absolutely terrible at everything it does. But the fact that it can do it, it's the joke about, you know, but such large portions, like you can just have so much of it mm-hmm. that it just seems amazing and ridiculous all at once.
Kind of like humanity, I suppose.
One can hope. That's probably the best we're going to get to, right? Like, let's hope for amazing and ridiculous. And I think that's us at our best.
Well, Paul Ford is a writer on technology and the web and many other things. In this case, he wrote Generative AI is Totally Shameless. I Want to Be It for Wired Magazine. Paul, thank you so much.
It was my privilege. Thank you.
All right, that'll do it for this Monday edition of the show. We will be back with you again tomorrow morning with much more as always. For Sam Dingman, I am Lauren Gilger. Thanks for joining us. That's it for this episode of the show's podcast. To find out more about the stories from today or other episodes, you can visit theshow.kjzz.org. And you can subscribe to KJZZ's The Show on your favorite podcasting site. I'm Lauren Gilger for Mark Brody. Thanks for listening today.